Off the Ball on News Talk 106 to 108.
I prepared to anything I can to play my country again.
Do it then. What about your start to the game?
It wasn't bad, was it?
Why should an honest answer be a mistake?
How can a modern day manager not have a mobile phone?
Why should he?
So still nil all between Leicester and West Brom. 50 minutes in the clock. It is not a classic. We'll talk to Graeme Hunter later this hour about Atleti 1, Barcelona 1, and Kevin Kilbane. Flight cancelled this morning. Come on in. Hello.
Hi, Joseph. How you doing?
How you doing? So you've been lounging around all day?
I've been what? Sorry, say that again.
Lounging around all day?
No. It's called getting things done, Joel. You know, I rarely get days off where I can actually do a few things. So I've had to just sort a few things out, get me things together, get everything in place. So yeah, hopefully I can make it into Dublin tomorrow. That's what I'm looking for. Yeah.
Good. Someone's texting. No electricity, lads. I'm sitting with the batteries in the radio, off the ball for company. The fire's on. I've got a few candles. It's very peaceful. Great radio. It's a nice image, isn't it?
Yeah, it's great. I listened to your stuff with Pat early on. It was great. Pat was as good as ever, really,
yeah,
earlier on.
Fun.
It's probably one of those evenings, isn't it, tonight? You know, when you see the devastation across the country at the moment, it's just it's dreadful scenes, really, isn't it?
Yeah, no fun at all. Really terrible. I must say, I naively or otherwise, I hadn't expected fatalities today. So that really added a horrible sense of sadness to proceedings when news came through of those deaths. So it's been strange old day. Dublin's been pretty much okay, by the way. I mean, no major trouble getting around or getting into work today.
Yeah, I mean, that's what I think. I think, you laugh around flight cancellations and things like that, but that puts everything into perspective with what is actually happening around the country, isn't it? And it's hopefully getting tomorrow, but there's certainly more important things than making flights and things like that.
Yeah. So you watched a lot of football over the weekend. I know you were in Match of the Day too last night, so you've probably seen your fair share. The Sunday Independent yesterday, Kev. Whew, dear, oh dear. I mean, if there's one thing I can't ask you enough about, it's Saipan, obviously, as you know. And Shay Given's book is being serialised, Shay, Any Given Saturday, and he's here in the Sunday Independent yesterday. And I never knew this about you or about the infamous meeting. Don't worry, by the way, I'm not going to spend the next 35 minutes talking to you about Saipan. So Given here has gone through that meeting. Why the F are you asking me a question? Who the F are you? You were a player, your worst manager, you're a W as a man, you're a W as a manager, you shouldn't be managing my country. Ouch, F you, and you can stick your F in World Cup. So all of that's going on.
And, what does W mean, Joe?
And yeah, and Shay says this goes on for about 8 or 9 minutes. Roy keeps it up, slating every last thing he doesn't like about Mick. The Ireland setup, our preparation, the delay in the delivery of our training gear, state of the practice pitch, and so on. And then he goes on to say, and I never knew this part, Roy is hemmed in because of the way the seats have been arranged around these tables for dinner later on. The only thing between him and Mick is Kev Kilbane, who just so happens to have sat in the worst place in the entire room at that moment. Shay writes, he's like a tennis umpire, looking left, then right, left, right, wondering where the next volley is coming from. I never knew you were in the middle. I never knew you could have stopped this.
Well, the thing is, Joe, if you'd have read my book, you'd have actually known that. So my book's been out for about 3 or 4 years now, so you know that you would have known.
Oh, I remember now.
There you go. It was actually over my left shoulder. So it was more over my left shoulder than anything else. So I'm thinking, if anyone's going to get a punch here, I will be in the crossfire, and I'm the one that's going to get a clout round the head. So that was pretty much how it went. That was pretty much how it was. Yeah,
bad seat choice there. Yeah. It's not really one where you can just stand up and get in the middle of them either. So you have to just sit there.
You couldn't even stand up. It was that tight, the way that the tables were set up. I was just in a position where I couldn't move. Nobody could move with the seating arrangement. So I was just having to sit there and listen. Just I was almost like a little turtle with my head going into my neck, just waiting for something to happen. But anyway.
Because Shay said it went on for 8 or 9 minutes, which I think has to be a slight exaggeration, because you couldn't just have Roy talking for 8 or 9 minutes. It might have felt like long.
Yeah, probably. It was a long time anyway. So it was a long time. There was a lot said without too much comeback, I have to say that. Yeah, but sometimes you may be in there for 3 or 4 minutes. It seems like 10 or 15, but it certainly was. It felt like a long time anyway.
Hmm. Well, there you are. So that's Shay Given writing his autobiography. I'm sure we'll get him in over the next few days and talk to him about that and a few other things.
Yeah, I was on to him yesterday, actually. I said, look, can you send me the PDF? Let me have a read of it. I said, look, don't worry, I'm going to buy it as well. He's so tight. He won't even send me. And his literal cut, his comeback was, what's a PDF? What do you mean? What are you on about? And that's the level that you're looking at there. So anyway, I had to like, no worries. No worries.
I mean, where do you start? Do you start by explaining the internet to him? I mean, it's hard to know.
It's a bit like that. She only got an iPhone about 3 years ago. He used to have one of those flip Nokia phones for 15, 20 years. So anyway, he moved on, fortunately, in the end.
Right. So you watched a lot of Man City Stoke.
I did. Yeah, I did. I heard you talking to Pat earlier on. The level that Man City are playing at, Joe, it's... I don't think we've seen this type of football in the Premier League. We've seen really good attacking football. We've seen greats in the Premier League, but the type of football 1-11, I don't think we've seen this type before. This is definitely from the sort of level that we would have seen from a Barcelona, from a Bayern Munich, and of course it's got Pep Guardiola's hallmark all over it. But we've never seen this type of football in the Premier League before. The way that they opened Stoke up at the weekend, I know you can look at it and say, yes, it's only Stoke, but look at the level they were playing at when it was 1-0, when it was 0-0. They were working on these patterns that we see Pep Guardiola's sides producing when it was 0-0 and 1-1. And I analysed it last night, Joe. I looked at the one. I think it was City's second or third goal. The goal that they were scored, it's come from the goalkeeper. It was played out, played into to Fernandinho initially. He played it out to John Stones. The build up from back to front. De Bruyne involved. David Silva involved. Then De Bruyne with that killer pass, the no look pass that I heard Pat talking about before, that freed up Sané, and then it freed up in turn Raheem Sterling. The level that they got to get that goal, just the movement off the ball, the creativity that was produced, the options that were available to every man when he was in possession of the ball. And I remember recently, in the last couple of months, when you had Stephen Kenny, when he talked about this way of, you know, not having three players in the line, the moving off that line to create options for your teammate. That was there in a nutshell, exactly. That was just the perfect template for what Pep Guardiola wants. It was just an incredible goal to watch from start to finish.
We'll do this on Facebook Live someday to make it easier. But when you say not having three players in the line, expand on that for people.
I suppose it's difficult when you've not got the actual diagram. Sure, it's basically creating angles. We talk about it so often, and Pat's been on the Stephen Kenny one, the footage. If you ever play that out, it's actually worth a listen to when Stephen Kenny speaks about it. But it's not as simplistic as saying, look, don't have three players. It's basically, you're looking across the pitch, and Pep Guardiola, how he works on the training ground, it's you don't want three players in almost, you'd say probably in direct line with each other across the width of the pitch. Literally, your fullback obviously in a more advanced position, your deep line midfield player, creating triangles all over the pitch. So it's basically passing options all over the pitch. So no one is basically being cut off in many respects when the man who's in possession of the ball that's allowing the opposition to get in line with them, so they prevents that pass getting through to them.
And sorry to interrupt then. So I can see that concept. So say, imagine the halfway line as an easy example. He doesn't want three players standing directly on that line.
That's a good analogy, yeah.
Do you watch football matches at Premier League level often and see players pretty much standing in a line like that? Because that would strike me as something that players would just avoid instinctively, no?
Yeah, there's a bit of that. It's not as awkward as I'm making it sound here, Joe. That's basically what it is. And I think in general, that wouldn't be the case. But you'll sometimes see a functional side when they're in possession of the ball. Everyone's in straight lines. Mm. I maybe relate to it in many respects as well. So if I would have played as a central midfield player I played with Roy when I was playing for Ireland. Roy Keane was playing for Ireland. Roy would never have wanted me to cross over. So you're holding your position, never cross over, never cross to make it difficult for me. Hold your position when we're in and when we have the ball and we don't have the ball. But you need to look at Man City at the weekend and see the goal that I just spoke about earlier on, and see the movement from Fernandinho when he took that initial pass from the goalkeeper. His diagonal movement from the left side corner 18-yard box. He then ran to the right wing position, diagonally across the pitch, across three or four different people. That in turn sucked Stoke players onto one side of the pitch, and it in turn freed up David Silva, who'd come from a deeper position. So it's I know what you're saying there is right. Yet you don't necessarily, if you're going to create angles when you're in possession of the ball, yes, you need to have players in advance. You certainly don't need three or four in a line. But constantly you see that when teams in possession.
Okay.
It's a simple ball sideways. But you're passing forwards in many respects then. You're passing into advanced positions in front of people, allowing people to run on into space. And that's what's freeing up space and what's giving people more time on the ball.
So City as a team have had to sit down with Guardiola, talk about all this stuff, digest it. Maybe it's taken a year. And now it's become almost instinctive. So I've just drawn my four little dots in a line here. And one of them is Roy Keane in midfield. And right to his left is Kevin Kilbane. When he says don't cross him. So say Roy has the ball. He doesn't want you to run infield across him. Is essentially what you're saying.
Well, say Roy's in an inside right position as a central midfield player. He doesn't want me to be running across him. He doesn't want me to come in. So I'm going out towards the right wing position in advance of him. And that's with and without the ball. So say when you don't have the ball and say a midfield player's gone the wrong side of your right-sided midfield player, he doesn't want you running out to him because in turn that then is freeing up a position somewhere else on the other side of you to my left, if that makes sense to you.
Yeah.
So basically you're vacating positions that's in turn freeing up. And that's exactly what Stoke did by that movement. If Stoke would have held the lines, would have basically passed runners on. So say you're in a position in a three like Stoke were on Saturday, not much communication. Darren Fletcher, Shaqiri, and Cameron. All you need to do is pass an information. So three players sucked into the run of Fernandinho when one player could have just dictated it from the base of that and just said, allow him to run across. Everyone's holding the shape, everyone's holding the space. And then that in turn doesn't free up David Silva when you don't have the ball. When you do have possession, as I say, he certainly doesn't want me running into that position because that in turn, that's almost condensing the play and giving him no options to pass to. So it's quite basic. It's quite basic in what you're saying within that. But City don't adhere to that without the ball. Sorry, when they have possession, it's a constant movement, a rotation of position that's freeing up individuals. The movement off the ball from Man City at the weekend is incredible.
Right.
And it's not off the cuff, Joe. It's worked on the training ground every single day, all day. And that's why it's coming out like it is at the moment. It's high-risk football, high-risk passing, but they're getting the rewards from it.
Yeah, because, I mean, look, you talk to people at City or you have a source there too, so they see what goes on with Pep. So by extension then, and we'll finish on this point then, so say Roy joined Man City, Pep would have been saying things to him, well, Roy, no, Kev Kilbane is going to cross you here and we are going to do it this way. And that's assuming you're at Man City as well under Pep Guardiola.
So, however unlikely that is, Joe.
Some of these basics that players would just have adhered to for most of their career, Guardiola is in a very deliberate way breaking some of those basic rules.
Yeah, that's exactly what it is. And I'm using Roy Keane because I would have played alongside.
Sure.
So you would know what he's saying to you on the pitch. But that would have been the same in Arsenal's midfield between Petit and Vieira. You know, left and a right footer, hold your position, up and down, one goals, one stays. Obviously, technically, very, very gifted footballers that can do things that I and maybe others couldn't have done. But very, very, it's almost functional, if you know what I mean. There's a bit of rotation off the wide areas, but your central midfield players, that's your pairing, that's your platform to build your attack from. Pep Guardiola is going totally away from all that. He's having Fernandinho, again, you just think of, holding midfield player. Mm. But he's finding himself on the left wing. He's finding himself on the right wing. Kevin De Bruyne is picking up balls. He's taking balls from the centre halves. And then in turn, he's playing as a number 10. He's getting in advanced positions to go and take the ball off of Jesus or off an Aguero. Mm. The rotation from the midfield three is incredible to watch. That's the thing when you go and watch it. And I like watching games. If I'm not at the game, I like watching them in the widescreen and, you know, in the tactical cam. And when you can see that and you see the rotation of the three midfielders and then how they interact between the two wide men, one, maybe Raheem Sterling might drop in just to basically get that rotation a bit further forward, and David Silva then might go into advanced position. There's no restrictions on positions. It's almost as if those positions now are non-existent within that City side. because even the fullbacks at times finding themselves in centre forward positions, and it's just the rotation, the movement. It's just, it's amazing. It is amazing. And anyone that's maybe gets the chance to go and see City live,
yeah,
and you're up in an advanced position, just have a look at the rotation and the movement on the players.
Is any other team doing it to that extent at the moment?
I don't see it. No, I don't see it. I've just seen West Brom just got in front there. Great free kick from Nasser Shadley. Brilliant free kick over the wall. So they've got 1-0 up at Leicester.
I don't think they're doing it somehow.
No, well, I mean, there again, talk about Tony Pulis' side. Yeah, that is a 4-2, 4-4-2, 4-5-1 system. Yeah. If you look at it, very, very functional. You hold your system, you hold your positions, don't break from those positions.
Yeah.
And then it's a certainly defensive-minded system.
The lads don't cross the line, that's for sure.
Most definitely. That's something that Tony Pulis is drilling into them on the training ground every day about don't get broken down early. That's the way that it is, yeah.
You talked there about the work Pep is doing on the training ground every day. Interestingly, Shay Given's back to his book, Serialised in the Mirror today, and he was talking about how much he hated training under Roberto Mancini. And so he's saying, at most clubs I've been at, you do a bit of team shape on a Thursday, which leads into the weekend, and you'll do 11 versus 11 for the team shape. The two teams would be the rough starting 11 against the custard pies who were on the bench. But at City, under Mancini, it would just be the starting 11 against nobody. Ghosts. Yeah. Nothing. I'd roll the ball out to the right back. He'd pass it back to me. I'd pass it to the centre half. He'd pass it back to me. I'd kick to Bellamy or Stephen Ireland. He'd dribble at walking speed towards their goal. They'd pass it to Tevez or whoever, and he'd score into an empty net. Effing hell, even I'd score in those circumstances. It was weird because it wasn't even done at any great pace or intensity, so I couldn't work out the point of it. Last time I checked, when you kick off on a Saturday, you had 11 men in front of you, but we still did it every week. And I mean, maybe to a point it ties in with what Michael O'Neill is doing. Like, we're wondering about Martin O'Neill and what's he doing sometimes in training, but clearly he's getting results. Michael O'Neill, very, very diligent and going through bit by bit. Like, I'm not sure what the Mancini logic is there. I know Arrigo Sacchi at Milan, they would work on team shape without any opposing team in front of them.
Giovanni Chiappettone used to do that.
Right.
He used to do that at times. What we used to do with Chiappettone, we would have done it at the start of the session, so he would have had the 11 out working on, I wouldn't want to say rotation, because there was very little rotation within the system of the side, within the function of the team, but it was about the setup plan, the startup plans, and then you would gradually introduce players into that. So you'd probably introduce three attacking players, so you're playing around them, playing around the attacking players from a defensive point, from a build-up point of view, defensively, having the ball back into shape might have been back out to the right back, you start up your play. Then there will be midfielders introduced to prevent that ball being played into the middle of the park. Then eventually you build it up to an 11v11. That's kind of basic stuff, but I mean, I actually didn't know that about Mancini, that functional stuff. It's called shadow play, essentially. So you're basically playing against no one. It's more for the function of the side, just to get people get used to the positions and the rotation, if you're having rotation within that. And in turn, that's when the 11 comes in. If there is rotation in midfield or up front, then that hopefully then should then start to transmit as you start to get away from people and the opposition can't deal with it. But when you're doing that just 11v nothing, that sort of shadow play, it doesn't really work out well at all, I don't feel, because it becomes quite static, it becomes quite lethargic training. I would have had it where we would have done that sort of thing with Howard Wilkinson as well. And I probably played my best football at Sunderland under Howard Wilkinson. But every day we come off the training ground, virtually every day during his, I mean, it wasn't a great five or six months. It was after Peter Reid was sacked, before Mick McCarthy took over. We had a dreadful spell, but we were working on things where I felt as though every single day, I would have always been a player, probably with my body shape, with my physique, I would have wanted to be, I would need to be getting a training at high tempo every day to get the best out of myself. I'd feel going into a game on a Saturday, I would be having to get basically working at 95% of my capacity every day. That's the way that I used to feel best. That's the way that I always felt good. I felt as though I was working at 50% of my capacity with the training we were doing. I felt as though I was going into games lethargic. I didn't actually feel fit enough. And that was the training that we were doing, because it was functional stuff. That's the sort of things that Tony Pulis does as well at times. Tony Pulis works on 11v11s a lot, and it's a lot of stop, stop, start play. You never really get into the full flow of a game. So it's stop, someone's out of position, work on getting that man back into position, and then you go again. It's quite it's quite slow. It's not necessarily getting a sweat on. Mm. And lads are finishing training thinking that you need to be actually doing a bit more. But he'd never let you do more. You had to go in, you're done for the day, save your legs for tomorrow. You come in, you do more of the same. And that's how it was Monday to Friday. So when I felt I was going into the games, I probably didn't feel 100%. I didn't feel fit enough. As I said, it probably defeats what I'm saying here because I actually played my best foot. Yeah. I was probably one of the better players during that spell, yet I didn't actually feel 100%. I felt as though I could have actually done more during that spell under Howard Wilkinson. But I don't know, it's just the way that it was. I think that's the way that he was drilled. That's the way he got his Leeds side, his Sheffield Wednesday side prior to that. Very, very functional, very difficult to play against. And it was almost as if you were trying to win a game from getting a set piece and winning off a set piece. And I didn't feel as though it was great. It certainly wasn't great for me, I don't feel, training-wise, day to day. But that's how he goes about it. That's how Tony Pulis goes about it.
Mm. Boring, stale after a while as well?
Yeah.
Waking up on a Tuesday thinking, ugh.
Well, you want to get in, you want to go in. Yeah, well, that's exactly how it is. You want to go in and you want to have that enjoyment factor to going in. You want to look forward to going into training.
Like coming into off the ball.
Well, exactly. I mean, it's only with you, Joe, and one or two of the others. You know, when I sat in studio with Richie for too long, it probably gets a little bit boring, but that's just Richie for you, isn't it?
It's a needless attack on Richie McCormack.
Well, yeah, harsh but true, I suppose. But, I mean, no, but the one thing, Joe, when you're training, and the one thing that coaches, certainly when I'm thinking about some of the coaches that I would have had through my career, always leave the players or take the players off the training ground wanting more. Always take them off so that the session's high tempo. It's excellent towards the game and everyone's fizzing. The ball's fizzing round and everyone's buzzing. Then when they feel as though they can actually, you know, say you're in a five-a-side and you're having three thirds or whatever it would be, and then at the end of that third, then you think it's a draw, it's 4-4, whatever it would be, and then come on, let's do an extra bit more. No, in you go, lad, you've done enough. And the lads wanting more leaving the training ground. That's the enjoyment factor. That's where you feel as though there's more to come from the team, I think, going towards the game on a Saturday. Whereas when you're going and doing that functional work every single day, it does become very repetitive. Yeah. There's no change. There's no real buzz around the training ground. And when you're going into the changing rooms after training, it's a little bit lethargic and a little bit downbeat.
Yeah, I can imagine. So, we talked a lot about Liverpool United with Pat. I'll get your take on that game, but I know you did cover the Watford win over Arsenal. And
yeah,
Troy Deeney, the equaliser himself, was talking here. In some ways, this is the most damning criticism of Arsene Wenger and of Arsenal generally. And, I mean, Troy Deeney did it in such a nice, lovely way. He was kind of smiling and just being honest about things. So, Troy Deeney here was asked about Arsene Wenger's suggestion that the penalty call won Watford the game. Deeney came on as a sub in this game.
I'm not going to be one to tell Mr. Wenger about himself, but there's a reason the loss, and it wasn't because of one penalty.
What do you think it was?
I have to watch what I say on leave, but yeah. Having a bit of cojones, I think the word is. Yeah, having a bit of nuts.
I think you can get away with that.
Yeah, having a bit of nuts. Just having a bit of... Whenever I play Arsenal, and this is just personal, whenever I play against Arsenal, I'll go up and I think, let me whack the first one and let's see who wants it.
Yeah.
And I come on today, I jumped up with Mertesacker. I didn't even have to jump, actually. Nod it down, the crowd gets up. Yeah, we've got someone who can win it. And they all just backed off. So for me, as a player, I just go, happy days.
Do you know the worst part of that? We could literally play that to the Arsenal team before every match for the rest of the season. And it still wouldn't change. I mean, they would not be upset or angry or outraged, really. That's the most damning thing I've ever heard any player say about another team.
It's unbelievable. Well, Joe, you're spot on with that as well. Most of the managers that I ever would have had would have played that. They would have played it the following day. That's what fellow pros are saying about you. That's what they think about you when they're coming in. I doubt Arsene Wenger would do that. I don't think that's his psychology. But if you, I actually saw it. I think anyone that you'd probably be able to get the clip on Twitter and things like that. Look at Martin Keown sat beside him when that's going on. Martin Keown can't sit in his chair. He's edgy. He's tetchy, and immediately he says, if I'm Arsene Wenger, I'm playing that to my team. Exactly what I was thinking when I saw it, because that is unreal to say that about a fellow pro, essentially. I do, part of me thinks it's disrespectful, but that's his thinking. That's what he thinks of. He's quite right to say that.
One of the reasons he's saying it is because he's also clearly so confident that it's not going to change anything for future games against Arsenal.
Yeah, you're spot on. And what's he going to do? The Per Mertesacker comes up in the next game, or Lauren Koscielny, or whoever it is, Rob Holding, and they go through him in the first minute. I think Troy Deeney would actually like that. He'd go, all right, then let's have it then.
Yeah.
I would that he'd relish that.
He'd say, let's see who can take this the furthest.
Totally. That's exactly what it is. So it doesn't make any difference to Troy Deeney. He's saying it in a way to wind them up. And maybe your point's vital, what you're saying there. It doesn't make any difference because Arsenal will not change the way that they go about things. That won't have any sort of effect on that side. All they'll do is, well, we'll play our way. And Arsenal may go on a run and win the next five games because they're on a great run of clean sheets. I think it was four clean sheets prior to that game. And Watford were never going to score, Joe. They won the penalty, yes, which was a bit soft, but I felt as though there was contact. So it ultimately was probably right. He did go over looking for it, but it probably was right. Mm. But they were never going to score from open play. And as soon as he got that goal, and when Troy Deeney come on, all they did, he just kept on pumping balls into Troy Deeney. He kept on backing in. He was looking for a fight and also weren't up for that fight. And they dropped off and Troy Deeney then brought it down, was able to bring teammates into the play. And all of a sudden, Watford were creating chances. They could have scored before Tom Cleverley got the winner. And it could have been more. It could have been three or four at the end. And Arsenal had gone from having a glorious chance with Mesut Ozil prior to that, and even the chance prior to that as well that Iwobi had. They had two great chances, could have gone 2-3-0 up, didn't take them, and then once that penalty went in, it changed the game, and Arsenal just went under and they bottled it. You can't say anything more than they actually bottled it.
One of the worst parts was the Cleverley goal. Even watching on TV, on the highlights, I didn't know the score of this game. I often will not catch a score deliberately for Match of the Day. It was just so noticeable that Cleverley was stood basically on the penalty spot on his own and Xhaka was the wrong side of him.
Yeah.
But like Cleverley didn't make a run. He just actually stood there waiting for about...
For how long?
10 seconds. Is that exaggerating? Yeah. About maybe 10 seconds?
Joe, I would urge anyone as well that's listening, watch it from the TV angle behind the goal. Granit Xhaka's picking his nose. I'm not joking. He's actually picking his nose on the edge of the box. It's just amazing.
Are you sure? Are you sure? I don't want to libel him. That sounds like a sackable offence.
Well, he's playing with his nose. That's what I would say then. He's playing with his nose, Joe, at the edge of the penalty area. It's not a lie. I saw it. I saw it yesterday. I saw it today. He's actually playing with his nose, scratching his nose, picking his nose, however he's doing it. And he stood there watching Tom Cleverley, who's about 5 yards away from him. And he is... For all that we say, Tom Cleverley's probably stood there for 5-10 seconds, whatever it is. Granit Xhaka stood there for 5-10 seconds. Doesn't sense the danger, doesn't take responsibility and doesn't get back. And Tom Cleverley, in fairness, Tom Cleverley had to go high with it. It was a risky finish at the end, albeit many might think it was an open goal, but he had to go high into the net because Mertesacker and Cech, I think it was, were diving down at his feet. It was a good finish at the end. He actually played well, Tom Cleverley, at the weekend. Mm. But Granit Xhaka was playing with his nose. If you don't want to say picking his nose, he was playing with his nose at the edge of the penalty area.
Tomato, and tomato.
It was ridiculous. Joe, it was ridiculous.
I didn't realise that. So that's interesting. So then Liverpool, Manchester United. I know you heard Pat, so we talked about a few different aspects of this. Pat's point about Manchester United players looking poor in the ball because they wouldn't have had many options because players didn't go forward was a very interesting point I would accept. And then you had the other weird dynamic of United players still trying to play and do what they would ordinarily do. It was almost like they were unprepared for having no options in the ball. Like I was saying to Pat, surely if they're going to just sit deep like that, then almost get rid of the ball early, give it to Lukaku, go long, see what he can do. But they were almost trying to play football, but then giving each other no options. So Manchester United on the ball were putrid. They literally did not put 6 or 7 or 8 passes together in the entire game. And then, I don't know, Liverpool, it's hard not to feel it was a bit toothless ultimately.
Yeah, probably agree with that as well. The save from David De Gea, Lukaku had the chance as well. There wasn't many chances in the match, really, was there? And that's the thing that disappointed, given the hype, given the build-up. But we spoke about it last week, Joe, didn't we? We kind of thought, Mourinho might come and do this. He might make the game the way it actually turned out. So it wasn't too much of a surprise, we have to say that. But you're right in saying that the quality was poor from United's point of view. Yes, it was. Where was Lukaku's movement ahead of the ball? For all that, he didn't necessarily get the service, but was he looking to spin off the shoulder of defenders? No, he wasn't. Because you'd have to say, and we've been talking about maybe tactical build-up towards games and functional stuff on the training ground, did Jose Mourinho work on the attacking side of his game, or was it purely to go there and stop Liverpool? It suggests to me the way that they played, the way looking at that game, because There was no real forward movement off the ball. Watching United this season, there has been good forward movement off the ball. There has been pace in the team. There has been direct running with the ball as well, largely from Rashford and maybe Martial as well at times. But there has been that movement. But when United won the ball, it was almost as if they didn't know what to do with it because they were just sat in the shape trying to contain United. And anyone that runs out of position, you're going to get a shouting at from Rooney up the touchline. So why break your line? Just stay in the compact shape of the team and see spells through in the match. They could have had a penalty, Liverpool. I felt it probably was a foul on Coutinho. It would have been a soft one to dictate the outcome of that game, given that nothing had happened. But that's how United lined up, and that's what Mourinho wanted. It was almost as if he was quite content just to defend and not actually put any thought process to the attacking side.
Our last point on this then, because our time is nearly at an end. The way Manchester City are playing, that's not going to be good enough. A point at Anfield this season may really not be good enough against Man City. And Manchester United on current form are good enough to go there and take the game to Liverpool and win, no? Like, I mean, I kind of think Mourinho was overly cautious here.
Yeah, I'm with you there, but I think that'll turn out to be a decent point. Okay. I do, John. Because of the course of the season, I might be proven wrong on this one, but I doubt very much that Man City can play to the level that they're playing at over the last two or three games across the course of the 38 games. I don't think they can. Mm. And they are probably, or more than likely, it would suggest that they're going to lose the odd game here and there as well. So if City went to Liverpool and they beat them and outplayed them, then you're looking at United and thinking, why didn't United do that? But I doubt they're going to be able to do that. I really doubt that that'll be the case when they go there. So I think Mourinho, they could have played. I think if United would have gone at them at times and would have shown a little bit more attacking intent when they were coming out of that functional shape, that defensive shape, I think there would have been chances for them. But they just didn't show it. So overall, we'll see. But I do think that going to Anfield and getting a point isn't the worst result. I would have expected United's side to show a little bit more attacking, yeah.
Yeah, and it was horrific for any of us who had to sit through it.
Dreadful.
Really, I just couldn't get over how boring it was, frankly. Mahrez has just scored a really, really good goal for Leicester. So it's 1-1 in that game, 81 minutes on the clock. It was a chest and then took it with his right foot. Really, really good volley. So 1-1 between Leicester and West Brom, 10 minutes to go. Kev, we're done. That's your day's work done. That wasn't bad.
That's it. I tell you what, Joe, it doesn't get much better. I might actually just stay here all the time then now. Or I might do, when I'm in Dublin, I'll just ring in. Tell JP I'll ring in.
I picture you now in your boxers and your vest, cup of tea.
Do you know what? That is me. I'm in my boxer shorts and my vest. Honestly, Joe.
You better not be. I don't want to talk to any man in his boxers.
I'm in my pants and vest watching football. It doesn't get much better, honestly. It just doesn't get much better than this.
Listen, that is an image which has sent the women of Ireland crazy.
Yeah, that's it. It's turned the women off. That's what it has done.
All right, listen, thanks a million. We'll see you tomorrow, hopefully.
All right, good man. Cheers, Joe.
Cheers, Kevin Kilban there. We are back in a minute. Graham Hunter. Forgot his name. I've barely talked to him. How can I be expected to remember Graham Hunter's name? Graham Hunter is going to talk to us about Atleti Barca, which was a cracker, and we're going to do that next.
Off the ball.
In association with Air. Don't miss live and exclusive Premier League action this month on the Air Sport Pack.
This is News Talk.
You're welcome, Max. So they're into the 90th minute between Leicester and West Brom. It's still 1-1, and Mahrez equalised after Nasser Chadli scored the opener. So 1-1 between Leicester and West Brom with about a minute to go. So, Graham Hunter, due to speak to us about Atletico Madrid and Barcelona, which finished 1-1 and was a bit of a cracker, but he's gone AWOL. So, we're going back to the bloke in his boxers, is the truth. Hello.
Hi, Joe. How are you doing?
Well, you know.
But do you know what it is? Well, because you forgot Graham Hunter's name.
I'm not happy with Graham Hunter.
He's listening to the show. You forgot his name and he's just thought, sod you. I'm not going on that show if Joe Malloy can't even remember a name. I think it's disrespectful, Joe.
I dare say that's not what has happened, but I will text Graham later to find out. Don't you worry. So we'll come back to Atletico Barcelona at some stage. I know you didn't catch that game. It was amazing. In every single way that United Liverpool was frustrating, just the United players, their touch being off or struggling to put any passes together, or, you know, just those tiny little moments, quick thinking or quick touches or cleverness, which ultimately make up an entire game. In every way that at Anfield, it was drab and kind of frustrating to watch. Oh, man, in Madrid, it was such an antidote to it. It was amazing. It was such a brilliant game and the atmosphere. And yeah, it was class.
I think that's it's a disappointing thing. I did miss it. There was so much on over the weekend, and it's difficult, isn't it, to try and keep up with them all. But it was one of the games that I would have wanted to see for, I think, contrasting styles, but yeah, also the quality that's overlooked from Atletico Madrid's point of view as well. When you see them and the pace that Atletico play at, when they've got to play and raise the game for the Real Madrid games or the Barcelona games. I mean, I was lucky enough to be at the Champions League semi-final over the last couple of seasons and I saw the semi-final against Barca a couple of seasons ago when they put Barcelona out. I was at the semi-final last season when Real Madrid put them out. And the pace that they play at, and they have to play at to compete, it's incredible. And that's the thing when you look at City at the moment. I've talked before about the rotation and the different positions that they're taking up. That's the level that City are going to have to maintain if they're going to compete with these clubs on a regular basis in the latter stages of the Champions League, yeah.
Mm. I mean, we're talking about Harold Wilkinson and Roy Hodgson and the Tony Pulises who work on shape. It's amazing. Simeone, you've seen him training Champions League, the eve of the Champions League matches. And, I mean, for like such brilliant players playing at an unbelievable level, that is basically what he seems to be doing in the stadium the night before games?
Well, he does things that, without the ball, Joe, he does things with no ball at all on the pitch.
Yeah.
And everybody's lined up in, when I would have seen it, would have been like in a 4-5-1 shape to the side. And so he'd have the one striker, I think it was Torres actually was playing the game. And he has players in positions, in a functional position of the position anyone can imagine. If you're looking at the side that's on your TV screens, when you'll see a 4-5-1 system, four defenders, four midfielders, it would have been Griezmann off Torres up front, and he has two cones either side of your position, maybe 5 or 10 yards ahead of you, and he blows his whistle, and that's for every position on the pitch, whether you're right back, centre half, left back, two cones ahead of you, two little discs on the floor.
Right.
He blows his whistle, and every player runs, and he'll point to whether it's left or right. Every player then runs 10 yards diagonally left if he blows his whistle a certain way. If he blows it twice, I think it is, he runs to the right. If he blows it once, runs to the left. Every single player in the side does it for about 25, 30 minutes, just continuously all over the pitch, and it's to get the shape of the side right. Distances between each other, whether it's two centre-halves, out to the right back, out to the left back, 10, 15 yards apart, no more than that. And when he's blown his whistle, everyone's just sprinting to the cone, and then back into the shape of the side. But everyone's going in the same direction, if you know what I mean. It's almost if the ball's been transferred to a certain way. He blows his whistle, everyone goes together, and he just does that continuously. And it's sharpness, but it's also just maybe the mental knowledge and the mental pictures that you're putting in your head when the opposition's in the ball. It's amazing to see. Different sort of contrasting coaching techniques, yeah.
Yeah, so it seeps into their consciousness, really. And it's as if ball has just been passed out to opposition left winger, right back is going out to meet him, and everybody moves in unison.
Yeah,
the spaces are the same.
Spot on. You probably described that better. Yeah, the right side centre half. So he's 10 yards away from the right back. Left side. Every single one of the 10 outfield players all moving in unison with each other to try to plug any gaps that might come about by a switch of play however it would be across the pitch. It's just unbelievable to see. That's the sort of thing that Simeone would do with his 11, yeah.
And like players of this calibre who must be just so frankly bored of it and thinking, oh, look, really, look, we get it. Just can we not do this again? Can we just play a bit of football and play a five-a-side?
I think he'd get a balance. I think he'd need to get that sort of balance at Simeone. That would be a functional sort of session the night before they're going to play Barcelona or Real Madrid. That wouldn't be the case, I don't think, every week. I think he'd probably work on that in small doses, and certainly the function of the side and the shape of the side would have been worked upon probably Monday to Friday, would imagine, the way that Simeone would work. But that sort of session would have been, I would have thought, specific to those bigger games when distances are key to maybe staying in matches or you could be getting beaten games.
Mm. Champions League tomorrow, we've talked up City. They're playing Napoli tomorrow, which is a really nice game. Because, I mean, Napoli are the great entertainers of Serie A.
Yeah, what a game. This should be a great game. Anyone that's been watching them, Napoli had an unbelievable result at the weekend. They went to Roma, beat Roma, stayed top. I think it's played 8-1-8 in Serie A now this season, Joe. They look so good. I think the 71 goals scored between City and Napoli this season. So it's probably going to be a 0-0 draw now when you build it up like that. But I think you're expecting a really good game. Then there's Liverpool, of course. There's some big games. But the interesting thing that I think that's probably come about today was Pochettino talking about Harry Kane being the Totti of Tottenham. He's expecting Harry Kane to come about and be that one player, that player that's going to play for Tottenham for the rest of his career. I don't envisage it to be that way. No. I really don't. But it's interesting to see that he's saying that now and putting it in Harry Kane's head.
Well, I was just thinking about this the other day. Is kind of the sad thoughts that I would have away from work even. So Danny Rose did his thing a couple of weeks ago where he talked about the low wages and the lack of activity in the transfer market. And the word was, fairly concrete word was, he got pretty much a standing ovation or cheers when he went into the Spurs dressing room.
Yeah.
So Harry Kane settling for, you know, a third or certainly half of what he could be earning. Harry Kane currently taking his 100 grand a week when he could be earning double or three times that and playing so brilliantly. I would contest he is the only thing holding that Spurs dressing room together. That as soon as Kane gets fed up with the wages or moves, then every single other Spurs player who is underpaid at the moment is going to down tools or go straight to Daniel Levy's office. I think at the moment, Harry Kane, because he's the alpha male in the dressing room and he's accepting it and he's playing so brilliantly, they're all kind of going along with it, but clearly not quite happily, because the Danny Rose example and the support for Danny Rose is self-evident. But I think as soon as Kane goes, or as soon as Kane starts to say, this is nonsense, we're not doing this anymore, look at the amount of money coming into the club, this is like, these days are over, Daniel Levy, I think what Pochettino's doing there is just pleading with every part of Kane that he can to keep this thing together. I actually think the Spurs situation is potentially a very dangerous one, even in the short term. I think like a year or two, the whole thing could fall apart suddenly.
Yeah, we'll probably get Tottenham fans on tonight. Again, whenever you talk about Tottenham in this term, it's like, oh, why are you always trying to sell Tottenham players? It's not the case. We've been realist around this. But I'm probably with you there. I think he could be the key to it all. See how long they can keep Kane. If Kane stays, then they're obviously going to have a big pulling power elsewhere. But you're right in saying that. It's interesting as well. You see Zinedine Zidane today talking about Harry Kane, talking about him being the complete striker, one of the best in Europe at the moment. When Zidane starts talking about you like that, you know there will be potentially a firm interest from him. If he wants you and Real Madrid wants you, I don't understand how Harry Kane can turn it down if that were to be the case. So I suppose it's watch this space, but his record now is getting on the level with some of the very best. I think it's 7 in 5 Champions League games that he's played. Is it 36, I think it is, in 32 this calendar year? That's comparable with anyone around Europe. It's certainly comparable with the Messi, the Ronaldo. So you're looking at his goal-scoring record and seeing what he's producing regularly now. He's putting himself on a different sort of plateau than anybody else in that Tottenham dressing room. Mm. And yet he's seriously underpaid for the rest of Europe. So if he were to be a one club man, Tottenham are going to have to break the bank in a way that they've never even contemplated. We know that he's the first 100 grand player to play for Tottenham. They're going to have to treble that to really keep him and say, look, we want to keep you happy, put some sort of structure in place. It's going to have to be 200-300 grand a week to keep him at the club.
One last point, and we only have about a minute here. Somebody's wondering if the game on Saturday at Anfield confirms, to some extent at least, that Lukaku's a flat track bully, because that was one of the accusations at Everton, that he's a flat track bully.
Well, we spoke about this. His record against those top six sides has always been quite poor.
Yeah.
He has been great at the start of the season. I think we will assess him probably after he's played against most of the top six, but there is still that question mark over his head given his performance at the weekend. I didn't see anything from him, Joe, without the ball. That was a thing that, when I've seen him this season, I think he's been working hard. I think his movement's been excellent off the ball, creating options for teammates. I didn't see it from him at the weekend. Mm. So, yes, I'd still put him in that category at the moment, that he's not produced it against all those big clubs.
Thanks for this. Who needs Graham Hunter, Kev?
Well, there you go. There you go. Me in my pants, Joe. That's all you need.
Yeah. No, that image has stayed with us. Thanks a million. We'll see you tomorrow. That's Kevin Kilbane for the second time this evening. On tomorrow's show, we'll be talking to the new Dublin hurling boss, Pat Gilroy. Andy Lee will be in talking boxing. And there is a small World Cup playoff draw to discuss as well. Tom Dunn is on the way next. Good luck.
Get my ball and the yard of grass. Give you a move for the perfect pass. Give my ball and he had a spice. He'll give you a move with guilty grace. Ra-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta.